Welcome to the new term, term four, last term of the calendar year. Trust everyone had a good Yontif, good Chagim. This topic we're going to talk about is an interesting topic called an ancient personal growth letter, which I'm going to explain in a couple of moments. Before I do that, I want to just talk about just two things briefly. One is just to, I know people probably got the email and know about it, I just want to make sure that everyone's aware that not this Shabbat, but the next Shabbat, the 28th of October, the Shabbos project, the Shabbat project, we're doing a Vaucluse pop-up shul. The flyers don't have the address, some of them, but it's 59 Wentworth Road. There's a program, we're going to do a little shiur before davening for those that want. And then 10 till 12, the Shabbat service. A little bit, we're going to do like some of the mindful minyan stuff as well, explanations and so on. Followed by Kiddush, L'chaim. It should be very beautiful, very interesting. And so all those that are able to come, pop in to the pop-up shul. Also, just want to point out, in part of the new program, we're doing a nighttime course, 30th of October and the 6th of November, called Kabbalah Meditation. It's a two-week course. It's related to some of the stuff we did when we did mindfulness and the flow of mind and heart, but it's for men and women, so it's a good chance to bring the men along if you want. If you can book into this particular course, just because I want to prepare course material and so on and so forth, so that's two Monday nights, yeah. Sorry, I should have put that there, actually. Yeah, Monday night. It will relate a bit to mindfulness, not completely, but a little bit, yeah. Related, yeah. Okay, so as we said, the topic for this term is called an ancient personal growth letter. Let me give you a bit of background so that it's a very interesting, hopefully interesting topic. It's a letter that was written, that's what we're going to go through it step by step over the next few weeks. It was a letter that was written by someone we refer to as the Ramban, Nachmanides. He was a 13th century Spain sage. His name was Rav Moshe ben Nachman. That's why it's called Ramban, Rav Moshe ben Nachman, or Nachmanides. He was born in Spain in 1195. He became one of the greatest prolific writers of Jewish law, Jewish commentary. His two main works actually are, what he's most famous for is his halachic commentary on the Talmud and his very deep and esoteric commentary on the Chumash. He eventually, I'll soon explain why, he eventually landed up in Israel, in the city of Akko. When he was 72, he settled in Israel after a very difficult journey. He had a lot of challenges in his life. One of them was in Spain, he was forced to debate. And he was ordered by King James of Aragon to hold a religious debate between priests. He was very limited, a lot of limitations were placed on him. Anyway, eventually he wanted to go away, and he settled in Israel. However, his family remained in Spain. So later on in his life, towards the end of his life, he wrote from Israel, from Jerusalem, or from Akko, according to some, he wrote this letter to his son, an ethical letter, an ethical will almost, right? He asked him strongly to read the letter, to live by the letter, and to review the letter, I think he said at least once a week. And that's the background. Now, the letter became known as Igeret HaRamban, the letter of the Ramban. It's a personal growth letter. Its lessons are as relevant now as they always were. And it became a very, very famous letter, which a lot of people read. Some people have a custom actually to read it or to try and read it, learn it once in a while, once a month, once a week, you know, whatever the case is. Incidentally, the concept of personal growth and self-refinement was something you find in Nachmanides' writings generally. He talks about a lot of the mitzvot, and in fact, one of his themes that he talks about is something we've touched on a number of times, that some of the moral values that the Torah communicates to us, for example, like Tzar Balei Chaim, treating animals kindly and not being cruel to animals and so on and so forth. He says it's not just for the recipient, but it's for the giver, right? Something we've talked about many, many times. So it's not only so that the animal should be protected, but it's for the person to become a better human being. When a person is cruel, no matter what it's to, whether it's an animal or another human being, whatever the case is, that makes the person more coarse, makes the person less refined, and so on and so forth. That's a theme that comes a lot in his writings, the concept of developing what he calls midot tovot, refined character attributes, defined personality, and so on and so forth. Now, it's a short letter because he uses very, very concise and sometimes cryptic language, very, very brief, and you can see that the words are very, very carefully chosen. And different commentaries on this letter divide it up in different ways. What I've done for this particular series is I've divided it up into 10 steps. Today we're going to deal with the first step, and over the next few weeks, we'll deal with some of the other steps. I'll just show you what I've broken it up into. Essentially, these are the 10 steps of this letter. The introduction, which we're going to deal with today, is about being open to growing. It talks about calm speech. That's one of his big things, about being calm in speech as a prevention for other negative things. He has a section on banishing anger. The letter is actually very well known for anger management. Humility is a big theme. Talks about relationship with God. Talks about general good character and the relationship to happiness. Quite a big section talks about banishing ego. Then he talks about communicating with humility. Very big on self-reflection. And finally, he talks about review. Reviewing the concepts again and again. So these are the 10 steps. We're going to try and go through it carefully, explore some of the ideas, try to unravel what he might have meant with some of the very short and brief chosen phrases, and hopefully develop the picture and understand by the end the entire letter. Okay. For today, we're just going to talk about the first phrase, his opening statement. In truth, his opening statement is not his. It's a phrase that he took from King Solomon, who wrote also a very famous personal growth book called Mishlei Proverbs, the Book of Proverbs, where King Solomon imparts his wisdom. A lot of that wisdom has to do with serving God, keeping the mitzvot, but a very big chunk of that wisdom has to do with general self-growth, right? And the Ramban, Nachmanides, begins the letter with the following phrase, and we're going to go through that phrase and really understand what that phrase means. It starts with the word Shema Bini, listen my son, Musar Avicha, to the instruction of your father. Ve'al titosh, and do not forsake Torat Imecha, the Torah, the teachings of your mother. Right? Again, it's not his phrase. It's a phrase from King Solomon. King Solomon uses it as an opening statement to personal growth. Nachmanides chose to use it. And that's the opening statement. Why do they use that? What, the letter of the Ramban? You can get it online. If you Google the letter of the Ramban, yeah, there's books that have it as well, books that have it with commentary, all different kinds. It's you good online, it's called Igeret HaRamban, right? Or the letter of the Ramban. Now, why does he start with this phrase? Because before he can begin a letter of personal growth, right? Before he can ask his son to live a life of refinement and to live by those values which he's communicating to him, to try and grow and become a better person all the time, there's a foundation that's critical. And it's the foundation is a two-way street, as we'll see in a second. And the foundation begins with the phrase, Shema Bini, listen. Meaning listen means, before we go into any detail, listen means be open to change. Be open to listening, right? No human being can ever change. No human being can ever improve without listening to others. Because if we remain within our own paradigm, as we've spoken about so many times, we remain stuck. Human beings have the capacity to change, but human beings have a disposition to remaining stuck, right? Because we are born with a certain personality, we're each born with a certain way of thinking. God gave each person a different perspective. I've very, very often quoted the Talmud that says, just like no two people look alike, no two people think alike, and therefore we have a perspective, we have a paradigm, we have a worldview, we have the way we look at things, and unless we entertain a different view, unless we entertain a different way of looking at something, unless we entertain a different perspective, it's impossible to grow. But it's not just a different perspective, it's also about being objective. Number one, we have our own view. Number two, we're subjective. And therefore, we have to entertain sometimes and listen to the constructive criticism or the constructive observations of other people. And therefore, that's the first thing. We need to learn. We need to explore ideas. We need to listen to other people. And we need to take it on board. And without that, it's impossible to actually grow. So the first thing is, Shema Bani, listen, my son. Just listen. Listen to other people. But let's take that a little bit further. Because that phrase, Shema Bani, right, actually has a number of different, just that those two words, have a number of different very, very important ideas. There's many, many ideas. I'm just going to share with you three. The first thing is the phrase Shema. That's interesting, of course. We use the phrase Shema in our prayers, right? Shema Yisrael, which is a phrase that Moses talks to the Jewish people in the book of Deuteronomy, and he says, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. What's the introduction of Shema? So I think I've told you this many times, that when I grew up in Yiddish, my father always used to tell me, if you want me to really listen to something, he'd ask me if I'm listening. And he would always start off by using the Yiddish word. He would say, Du hörst, do you hear? And which I would obviously say, of course, you know, of course I hear. And then his next question would be, because in Yiddish there's two words, it's called her and der her. He would say, no, nein, he would say, du der herst? Like, I know you're listening, you're physically, biologically, physiologically listening. But are you absorbing, are you internalizing, are you processing, right? So he's telling him not just to hear, which is lakshiv or lazin or lishmoa, right? But shema, the phrase shema, which is the same thing with the sentence shema Yisrael that Moses says to the Jewish people, it's about, are you really listening? Are you taking it on board? You know, Maimonides says, and this is a difficult thing, one of the most difficult things, we've talked about this as well in the past, he says one of the critical ingredients to tshuva or to growth or to improvement is to take on board tochacha, to actually embrace criticism. Now, that's not a natural disposition of any human being, to embrace criticism, right? Except for the people that do it naturally are normally people that do it negatively, which means they embrace all criticism, like, you know, just dump it on me, whatever you want, you know, kind of thing, right? But that's not a healthy thing necessarily, right? I'm talking about embracing criticism in a healthy way, to actually listen to people when they comment, and maybe they don't mean bad, and maybe they actually mean your own good, and maybe they're right, and maybe we should take it on board, and maybe we should apologize, maybe we should change, maybe we should explore a different system, right? It's about being open, it's about not being stuck, it's about shema, actually listening. So what the Ramban does, what Nachmanides does, he says like this, he says, I'm sending you this letter, right? But the first word of this letter is shema. Can we turn on the air conditioning? It's a little stuff in here, right?
Yeah.
Thanks, Yaakov. Just put it on for a few minutes until it gets too cold and we'll put it off. So he says like this, he says, before I can send you this letter, I want you to know like this. You can read this letter in two ways. And this is true with everything in life, by the way. You can read it in two ways. You can read something in two ways. You can go to a lecture in two ways. You can have a conversation in two ways. There are many things we can do in two ways. He says like this. You can hear it as something completely separate to you, divorced from you. You can read it as a good, interesting essay, as we sometimes do. You can look at it as a nice speech. You can look at it as an interesting analysis. You can do it as an academic study. You know, you can take the Ramban's letter. You can take this letter. We can all take this letter, and we can analyze it. You know, what was the? We can do a thesis on it. You know, what was the life of Nachmanides? What was his themes? What was his issues? What was the values that he liked to focus on and emphasize? And why did he emphasize those as opposed to others? We can do all of that. But when we do that, and that, by the way, is sometimes appropriate when we're doing an academic study. When you do that, you're doing it as something that is totally separate to you, right? The Nachmanides sends a letter to his son. He says, don't take this letter as some sort of sentimental legacy that I'm going to leave you after I'm gone, that you can read and your children can read, and it'll be a nice thing to remember me, right? He says, read it the second way, Shema. Read it in a way where it becomes yours. It's relevant to you. It's something that's applicable to you. It's something that has practical relevance, right? like the daily Shema. That's what Moses is asking us too when he asks us to say Shema. He says, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Moses is doing the same thing. He says, before I say this eternal Jewish line, God is our God, God is one, don't take it as an academic statement. Shema Yisrael, listen to it, absorb it, internalize it. Not hair, but der hair, right? Use the Yiddish term. So that's the first thing that Ramban, I think, is asking his son, Nachmanides is asking his son, before you start to read this letter, Shema, just listen, make it applicable, make it practical, make it yours, make it something that's your thing, not just something that you're reading something outside of you. The second part of that phrase is, says, Bini, my son. And this is such an important thing. He says, the reason that you can take this on board, and the reason I hope, he says, that you will internalize it and really apply it to yourself is because you're my son. Shema Bini. Not just listen, but listen, my son. What does that mean? He says, because you're my son, you can trust me. You can trust me, number one. And number two, you can know that I believe in you. In other words, because very often when we don't take admonishment, or we don't take criticism, or we don't take inspiration for that matter, properly on board in an internalized way, is because we don't know how the other person means it. Right? Now this is of course a very important two-way thing. When we talk about the son concept here, it's not just a physical son. It's every type of relationship. Every type of relationship where we have to sometimes tell people and have difficult conversations. Right? We can receive and hear things from other people when there's that trust, and we need to know that that's how we give it to other people as well. We can only really criticize people who we love, actually. Right? Sometimes people do it the other way around. We criticize the whole world except for people that we love. Right? And it should be that, now I'm using the word criticism loosely. I don't mean negative criticism necessarily, right? And I don't mean being overly critical, because that's not healthy. Parents, when they're just overly critical, it's very ineffective. But on the other hand, it's specifically people who we love, that if we really love them, sometimes that love actually needs to be expressed by telling them things that are difficult to tell them. Because we love them. And because we think highly of them, hopefully. Because we value them. If we really value people, then we protect them. And we nurture them. Nurture them means that we point out difficult things to them, but we do it in a proper way. We do it in a beautiful way. We do it in a trusting way. I think I've told you this many times, but I'll repeat it just in case those who haven't heard it. I heard this from my grandfather. Beautiful, beautiful idea. That they used to say about giving criticism, that there was this old practice in a shtetl where they'd have public bathhouses, where people would go, and in the bathhouses they would have a sauna called in Yiddish a Schwitzbad, right? Yeah, so it was and the way it was done apparently it was like this huge fire, and it was create this heat, and heat of course rises, and the person used to come and used to climb a stair. You get hotter and hotter, you get used to it, more used to it, and then on the top stair, when it was really completely very, very hot, and you were really schwitzing away, there'd be this guy there called a bedder. Bedder, it's a Yiddish word. A bedder means he would have like a broom with bristles in it, and he would huck you on the back, give you a big slap on the back with his broom, and apparently it was like a massage, I guess. It was like the most beautiful thing, right? So he says, an amazing thing, you get this good clap, this good zets, as they say, and the guy says, ah, geschmack, it's good. Give me some more, right? So he quoted, I think it came from the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe, he said, imagine if you're walking in the street, and the guy comes up to you with the same broom, and he gives you a clap on the back. He says, you turn around and you give it to him back. I mean, you'd be astounded, right? So what's the difference? Very simple. The difference is that the person, when he gave the whack in the Schwitzbad, he did two things first. He warmed him up and he lifted him up. He says, when you warm someone up and you lift someone up and then you give them a clap on the back, they ask for more. Right? It's a beautiful, beautiful lesson. Right? So the Ramban is telling his son, Shema Bini, it's not an easy letter. I'm going to tell you to get rid of your ego. I'm going to tell you to manage your anger. I'm going to tell you to be humble. I'm going to tell you not to be such a big shot. I'm going to tell you lots of things that are maybe hard to hear. Right? And I'm going to tell you to be concise. I'm going to tell you to be sharp. I'm going to tell you to the point. But I'm asking you, number one, Shema, be open, but be open, Bini. Understand you're my son. Understand that I'm telling you because I value you. And if you value something, you protect him. Right? It's the same idea generally how we look at ourselves as well. That's that whole self-esteem concept. Often when we fail or we do things that are inappropriate, it's because we don't value ourselves. If we valued ourselves, we'd be more self-reflective and sometimes we'd be more self-critical, not in a negative way, but we take more responsibility and we'd address our weaknesses in a better way because we value ourselves. Right? That's why there's a concept, you know, where we've talked about many times, where it says in Ethics of the Fathers, Asay l'charav, make for yourself a mentor. Each person has to have people that they can listen from. And those mentors don't have to be great scholars. Those mentors don't have to be people who know infinitely more than I do. They have to be, there's a couple of ingredients to have a good mentor, a spiritual coach. One is they have to not be me, that's number one, because I'm subjective and they're not. So that means I can get an objective view. And the second, it has to be someone I trust, someone I know values me, who will be open with me, frank with me, but also looks at me in a positive way. It's not that when they're critical, they're not being critical to crush me, they're being critical to lift me, right? Because then it's easier to listen. You know, there's an incredible story in the Chumash. Now that we've started the Chumash again, we're going to read this in a few weeks' time, with Joseph. Famous story, Joseph when he was sold by his brothers down to Egypt, right? So the story goes, when he was sold down to Egypt, he was sold to an Egyptian politician, an Egyptian aristocrat called Potiphar. And he became very popular, became very successful in Potiphar's household. And then there was the whole incident with Potiphar's wife. She tried to seduce him, right? And it's a very, very complicated part of the Chumash. It was a tremendous challenge for Joseph. He was a young boy, forsaken in Egypt, had no family, and was just down in the dumps. He was completely disconnected. He had nothing. And he's in the home, and one day she's trying to get him, and he keeps on refusing. And then one day, the Chumash told us, everyone went out, and she played sick, and she stayed home. And he came to the house to do stuff, to manage things. And she cornered him, right? And it says there, Vayema'en, and he refused. I think I've shared this with you before, the notation on the word Vayema'en is a zigzag. It happens a few times in the Torah, which the zigzag symbolizes hesitation. Because the Talmud tells us it's not as simple as it reads. That when Yosef, that final time, Yosef almost gave in. He almost gave in. He hesitated. He struggled. Right? What stopped him? So the Talmud says, what stopped Joseph was, suddenly he had a vision. Says Dmuti Yokno Shel Aviv, the form and the face of his father appeared to him, right? And he stopped, and he withdrew, and he refused, and he ran away. Ultimately, she slandered him, and he landed up in jail. So the simple reading of that is, he had this vision of his father. You see, his father's looking at him. How can he do this? You know, that kind of thing. So he remembers his father doesn't do it. But a deeper commentary says the following: what does it mean his father's face appeared to him? Not that he saw his father's face. But he suddenly remembered how his father appears to him, which means how his father looks at him. He remembered how much his father values him and what kind of importance and prominence and value that his father trusts in him. And he thought to himself, well, if that's the case, how can I do that? Right? When we understand that people who respect, if we know how they look at us, we aim to be better, we aim to improve. So therefore the Ramban Nachmanides is telling his son, Shma Bini, listen my son, because it's a son and there's a trust, it's not because I'm a great scholar, it's not because I'm telling you things that are so clever. Nachmanides happened to be a great scholar and a great sage. But he's saying it's more, I want you to be open to change, and I want you to be open to change for me because we have a son-father relationship. Because I trust you and that's the way I look at you. I'm just going to show you a little clip. It's a little bit connected. It's just something that I thought was very, very cute. It's a guy that I've forgotten his name. He wrote a book about lessons from a third grade dropout or something. And so it's very good, yeah. So I just surfed on Facebook recently, so I thought I'd show you just it's a longer thing. I'm just going to show you the first 3 minutes of it. But it just brings out a little bit this point about a guy who learned his lessons from his father. And you could see it was out of love. He just learned the lessons. They were simple lessons, but they're just lessons he learned from his father because he trusted him.
Like Microsoft Works, don't know your name. country music, but I've lived in Texas so long, I love country music now. I finish, I have cowboy boots and cowboy, y'all, I'm a black neck redneck. No longer oxymoronic for me to say country music. And it's not oxymoronic for me to say third grade and dropout. That third grade dropout, the wisest person I ever met in my life, who taught me to combine knowledge and wisdom to make an impact, was my father. A simple cook. Wisest man I ever met in my life. Just a simple cook. Left school in the third grade and helped out on the family farm, but just because he left school doesn't mean his education stopped. Mark Twain once said, I've never allowed my schooling to get in the way of my education. My father taught himself how to read, taught himself how to write, decided in the midst of Jim Crowism, as America was breathing the last gasp of the Civil War, my father decided he was going to stand and be a man. Not a black man, not a brown man, not a white man, but a man. He literally challenged himself to be the best that he could all the days of his life. I have 4 degrees. My brother is a judge. We're not the smartest ones in our family. It's a third grade dropout daddy. A third grade dropout daddy who was quoting Michelangelo, saying to us, boys, I don't have a problem if you aim high and miss, but I'm going to have a real issue if you aim low and hit. A country mother quoting Henry Ford, saying if you think you can or if you think you can't, you're right. I learned that from a third grade dropout. Simple lessons. Lessons like these. Son, you'd rather be an hour early than a minute late. We never knew what time it was in my house because the clocks were always ahead. My mother said for nearly 30 years, my father left the house at 3:45 in the morning. One day she asked him, why, Daddy? He said, maybe one of my boys will catch me in the act of excellence. I want to share a few things with you. Aristotle said, you are what you repeatedly do. Therefore, excellence ought to be a habit, not an act. Don't ever forget that. I know you're tough, but always remember to be calm. Always. Don't ever forget that. Never embarrass Mama. Yeah. If Mama ain't happy, ain't nobody happy. Next lesson. Lesson from a cook over there in the galley. Son, make sure your servant's towel is bigger than your ego. Ego is the anesthesia that dims the pain of stupidity. Y'all might have a relative in mind you want to send that to. Let me say it again. Ego is the anesthesia that deadens the pain of stupidity. Pride is the burden of a foolish person. John Wooden coached basketball at UCLA for a living, but his calling was to impact people. And with all those national championships, guess what he was found doing in the middle of the week? Going into the cupboard, grabbing a broom, and sweeping his old gym floor. You want to make an impact? Find your broom. Every day of your life, you find your broom. You grow your influence that way. That way you're attracting people so that you can impact them.
Yeah, so it goes on, by the way, for a while. That's beautiful. You can Google it. I caught my attention because it really relates to what we're talking about. These are simple lessons, profound lessons. But I think he took them on board not because of the cleverness of the lessons. I mean, they are clever, but because it came from someone he loved and loved him and trusted him, which is really a two-way street in a way. And I think it's a double lesson, how we influence others. You know, we talked about this when we talked about leadership. We're all leaders. Everyone is a leader. Everyone has to influence others. Everyone has to impact on people. But if we're going to lead and we're going to guide other people, we have to believe in them. If we don't believe in them, we can't guide them. You can't influence anyone you don't believe in, which is almost contradictory sometimes, because sometimes we want to guide those people we don't believe in, so we want to show them how stupid they are or how wrong they are. It doesn't work. So if we don't believe someone can change, then don't bother telling them. Rather, ignore them. But to influence people, to lead people, we actually have to believe in them. There has to be that, almost that son-parent relationship. They have to be our children. And understanding the other way, where the Ramban says to him, because I believe in you, that's why Shema, that's why you can listen. You can be open. You can take it on board because it's coming from someone who really believes in you. And that's the second little thing coming from the word Shema B'ni. Thirdly, the concept of Avicha, your father, about the need, and I just wanted to mention that because I think it's something that's so important in today's time as well. Something to respect ancient wisdom and its relevance. I think part of society's problem today being a society that we are very, very advanced and technologies at all our levels, and we've come up with the most amazing things never thought of in entire history, is that we tend to throw everything away. We tend to throw the wisdom of the ancient wisdom away as well, thinking that because we're more advanced in so many other areas, so therefore we must be more advanced in values, we must be more advanced in wisdom. And it's so untrue. It's interesting that, you know, we've often quoted Pirkei Avot. Pirkei Avot is the one part of the Talmud, it's a section of the Mishnah which deals with ethics, with values, right? What is it? It's interesting what it's called. People don't often pay attention to it. It's called Pirkei Avot, that's what it's called. Chapters of the Fathers. In English, that's the ethics of the fathers. It's actually not. Pirkei Avot means chapters of the fathers. Ancient wisdom, that's what it is. And that's such a Jewish concept. That's where the whole honoring parents comes in, and learning from elders, learning from elder people, and so on and so forth, because there's eternal wisdom, there's amazing wisdom. We need to know how to apply it to our own context, to contextualize it, and so on and so forth. But there's amazing wisdom, and wisdom, you know, certain things get less with time. Certain things advance with time. But wisdom, ancient wisdom, is stronger than current wisdom. And we need to understand how to be able to glean that, how to be able to learn from that. And that's the first, that's the second, the third concept in Shema B'ni Musar Avicha. Nachman said to his son, listen, my son, to the instruction of your father. Just because it's the father, there's more life experience. There's experiences which we never had, which we can learn from people who did have them. And that's part of the journey of personal growth, is to understand and to absorb that, to respect wisdom that came before us, came with better life experience than us, came with different experiences than us, and to take it on board. So those are the three concepts of Shema B'ni, his opening words. Listen, my son, number one, as we said, don't just hear, but listen, take it on board, make it relevant, make it your thing, be open to change. B'ni, the trust, love issue, that's why you can take it on board. And thirdly, respect ancient wisdom. Okay. The second part of the phrase is Al titosh Torah timecha, which means don't forsake the Torah, the teachings of your mother. So what does this mean? Now this is, as I said before, this is a verse in Proverbs. It's King Solomon's verse. Listen, my son, to the instruction of your father, and don't forsake the teachings of your mother. Right? What's the mother-father symbolism here? So again, a couple of ideas. I'm going to share with you two ideas. First of all, the mother-father symbolism, as explained in the Talmud, is perhaps connected to the following idea. In the Talmud, there's a big discussion about learning from someone, right? How you learn from a teacher. Now, typically, when we talk about learning from a teacher, it's formal instruction. You go to a class, you go to a lecture, as it was in Talmudic times as well. There were great sages. They would get up, they would give a lecture. They would teach a lot of Torah instructions, halakha, law, ethics, values, whatever the case was, and people would learn. That was the system. Lecture halls, study halls. Jewish people are famous. We're the people of the book. We are famous for, from time immemorial, the concept of learning. In fact, interesting enough, just by the way, the idea of learning and formal learning is so emphasized in Jewish history that the Talmud tells us that Jewish academies of learning, existed within the Jewish communities and Jewish families long before the giving of the Torah. Noach, this coming week we have the Parsha of Noach. We are taught Noach had some insight into the Torah concepts and he studied it, and his son and grandson established a yeshiva. A very, very famous yeshiva that's often mentioned in the Midrash, called Yeshivat Shem Va'ever. Right? Avraham Avinu learned, studied in that yeshiva. So learning has always been a very big thing. Yet, the Talmud tells us a very interesting line. Gadol Shimusha Yoter Milimuda, which means, the sages said, there were sages that said that they were like attendants. They got to be people who would serve and hang around certain sages, right? Not only come to the lectures, but they hung around in their homes. They helped them with preparing their meals or whatever it was. And they testified that they learned more from serving and hanging around the great teachers than in their lectures, right? What's that idea? The idea is, and it's a fascinating idea in education generally, you absorb and you learn and you pick up far more. Formal instruction is very, very important. But you pick up far more from culture, from the environment, from watching people do things, by watching people, observing people live by example, live by their values, and you learn infinitely more from that than you do from formal instruction. Now, not that formal instruction isn't important. It is very important. Because sometimes when you learn from an environment, you need to understand it and internalize it, and that you do from understanding things, from exploring values, from learning, from study. But as important as study is, learning by osmosis, learning from picking up from what people do, learning from people implementing their values, living by their values. You know, one of the great things in Jewish culture, for example, is telling stories of great sages. For example, there's a custom every Matzei Shabbat, every Saturday night, there's a custom of telling a story of a Baal Shem Tov or telling a story of a tzaddik, right? What's the idea? One of the ideas is, because before we leave Shabbat and we go into the week and we have to take the inspiration from Shabbat into the week, we don't only say over and repeat a teaching from a sage, but we rather tell a story, because a story is not what the sage taught. The story is how the sage lived. It's very different. Very, very different. That's why it plays such an important role, the concept of stories. Stories of great people, a very, very important, play a huge role in Jewish teachings. Why? Because you get to learn how they lived, not what they taught. So that concept, avicha and imecha, father and mother, the commentaries explain, represent those two ideas. Now, not to stereotype, and of course it's not always the way it is, but often it is the way in Jewish literature. The father is a symbol of the person who instructs. The mother is the one who brings up. The mother is the one who creates a culture, creates the environment. So Nachmanides comes and he writes a letter to his son. He says the following. And this is a possible interpretation of why he starts off with this verse. He says to him like this. Shma b'ni, listen, my son, to the instruction of your father. But don't forsake the teachings of your mother. What I mean by that? What I'm telling you is insufficient. What I'm telling you is only half the picture. But what you need to do is, don't just read this letter. Go hang out with good people. Go put yourself in an environment where you can see other people live this letter. Right? Surround yourself by people who are positive. Surround yourself by people who are growing. Surround yourself by people who are generating the same enthusiasm and excitement and aspiration and yearning to become better people, perhaps like you want to be. Because if you read this letter and you yes and you absorb it and you shema and you take it and it's part of you, but you don't surround yourself by the right positive inspirational people, and rather you hang around people who are not interested in this type of stuff. You hang around people who don't want to improve, who don't want to manage the anger, don't want to engage in humility, who don't want to engage in personal growth, it won't work. It simply won't work. Because you have to know how to live it. You have to put yourself in that culture. You know, in the Chumash, we have the famous story of the rebellion, the dispute between Korach and Moses. Right? And it's a fascinating thing that Korach was the one who stood up and he fought Moses. And he was a wicked person and the end was punished, and he tried to undermine the whole leadership of Moses and the whole authenticity of Torah and so on and so forth, as the whole story goes with Korach. We mentioned a number of times. One of the details of the Korach story, interestingly enough, that he came with 250 people. Who were those 250 people? He came with a whole gang. Who was the gang? They were members of the tribe of Reuven. You know, there were 12 tribes of the Jewish nation. Members of the tribe of Reuven. And the commentary says, what was wrong with Reuven? What was something in the water? What was the problem with Reuven? And they say a very simple thing. If you look at the map, if you read the Chumash and you understand how the Jews camped in the desert, there was the Mishkan, the tabernacle in the middle. Surrounding the tabernacle, there were four families of the Levites, the tribe of Levi, and surrounding them were the 12 tribes. The one closest to Korach was Reuven. Because the Talmud says, Oy l'rasha, oy l'shcheinoy. In other words, woe is to the wicked, woe is to the neighbor. Right? A neighbor is an important thing. We talk about shachen tov, a good neighbor. A good neighbor just doesn't mean someone who doesn't fight you in the body corporate. It means, right? You know, it doesn't get annoyed when you put on your stereo at night or something like that. A good neighbor means a good friend, someone who you surround yourself with, someone who you, that's not an important thing, I'm saying, you know. But a good neighbor means, and we pray, it's part of the morning prayers, praying for a good neighbor. You know, I'll tell you a fascinating thing. There's a section of Torah called Sarat. We don't have it today. It's leprosy, right? The idea of leprosy. Which, leprosy is probably a mistranslation, but it was more of a spiritual skin disease that took place in biblical times. We taught that it took place for talking Lashon Hara, whatever the case is. And there's three kinds of leprosy. There's leprosy on the body, the physical body. There's leprosy on clothing that used to develop sometimes. And there's leprosy on houses. right? And they all come with different instructions, different halachot, different laws. And the Torah tells us that if someone's house, a wall, develops leprosy, there's a whole process. You've got to go to the Kohen has to come and analyze it, if it's impure, if it really is leprosy, and that whole story. After a couple of weeks of back and forth, if it's established that the walls actually have leprosy, it's a sign of great impurity of the entire home, and the home has to be demolished. That's what it is. That's one of the 630 mitzvot Torah. Now, it comes with a bit of a thing also, because apparently sometimes it was a blessing in disguise. I'll just tell you, this is nothing to do with what I wanted to say, but I'll just tell you anyway. It was a blessing in disguise because some of the houses that the Jews lived in ancient biblical times was houses left over from the Canaanites who fled Israel. And they had very, very thick walls, and they knew the Jews were coming, and they hid a lot of their treasures in the very, very thick walls, at least that the Jewish people shouldn't get them. So sometimes God sent Sarat, we are taught, because it was a blessing that they should knock down the walls and find the treasures. Okay. But that's not always like that. But the simple reading of it is that it's an impurity. So the Talmud says, what happens? Analyzes the whole section, analyzes these laws. What do you do with these laws? What happens if there's a common wall? What happens if the guy lives in a semi-nebuch, right? That is, and there's a common wall, right? Got to demolish my home. That's very nice. What about the neighbor? So the law is, the wall's got to go. What happened to the neighbor? Poor neighbor, what did he do? Maybe I did something wrong, so I got leprosy on my walls. What did my poor neighbor do? Says the Talmud, no, because if I deserve tzarat, for whatever reason I deserve this level, intense level of impurity to permeate my home to the point where the home needs to be demolished and rebuilt, there's no way I didn't influence my neighbor. And there's no way that he's not subject to the same, not, of no fault of his own, other than he lives next door to me, maybe he should have moved, but he's influenced and he's affected by the impurity as well. So therefore, although it seems unfair, that's the law, because the proximity has a tremendous influence. People we hang around with, people we engage with, people we develop, the culture we become part of. Culture, like, this is so important in parenting as well, in all forms of education, school education, parent education, and just people together. It's not what we instruct. It is, too. But it's not just what we instruct. It's the culture we create. And culture has a much more much more powerful effect on people than instruction. So therefore, Nachmanides is telling his son, Shema Bani, listen to the instruction I'm going to tell you, but then go to people that will help you. Go to people who support you. Surround yourself with people where you'll live in a culture consistent with this letter that I'm going to write to you. Number one. That's the first lesson. Second of all is the following. The commentaries say about this verse, you know, in Jewish teachings we have what's called Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebalpeh, the written law and the oral law. The written law is called the father, the oral law is called the mother. Why? Because in our relationship with God, I'll just give you this introduction so you understand where I'm going with this. In our relationship with God, and when he gave us the Torah, the teachings, there's two parts. There's the giver and the receiver. We've talked about this before, giving and receiving. In the giver and the receiver, both play an important role. The give, in order to give, there has to be a receiver. In order to receive, there has to be a giver. So the two parts of the Torah, which are, by the way, considered both authentic parts of the Torah, the written law and the oral law, the written law is much more God's word, the prescriptive, specific, prescribed words, the five books of the Chumash, or the 24 books of the Tanakh, and so on and so forth. But then God gave us rules and processes of how to interpret and how to process and develop and expand and extrapolate the written law to develop what's called the oral law. Yeah, he gave us guidelines to stick to. We need to stick to those guidelines. But essentially, the oral law has a lot to do with the thinking of the sages, the thinking of the people, of how they interpret and how they expand upon it, and so on and so forth. That's why the written law is called the father, because male and female is giving and receiving, as we've talked about many times. So therefore, that's the oral law. The written law, the oral law is called the mother. So in everything, it works like that. There's the concept, and then there's the process. So Nachmanides tells his son the following. Shma b'ni musar avicha. Listen to me, the instruction of your father. I'm going to give you the principles. Right? So we said before, but then you have to hang around with people that implement it. But it's more than that. I'm going to give you the principles, but you need to work hard as well. Personal growth means we cannot just learn ideas. Personal growth requires a lot of processing on our part. It requires individualized implementation. It requires each person to think, how are we going to implement this? What's the oral law? How are we going to take it? There's the giver and the receiver. There's immutable, there's axiomatic values which we learn, especially in Judaism. The Torah provides us with axioms, with objective morality, absolute moral concepts. But how are we going to put them into practice needs an incredible amount of processing. It needs an incredible amount of thinking, individualizing, contextualizing, and understand how we're going to make it work for us. And often, very often, personal growth ideas don't work, not because we don't understand the ideas. We understand them very well. But we miss out on how we're going to make it work for us. For example, one of the concepts of the Oral Torah, not the only one, but one of the ideas, just to use that model again, is the concept of protective boundaries, right? So we have it sometimes where, just in rabbinic law even, we have sometimes where the Torah gives us a mitzvah, and the rabbis say, okay, so we're going to put some boundaries on that. Don't even do A because you'll come to B, right? We have the Shabbat, we have many, many things, right? And the same is true in the way we develop as human beings. So for example, and we used this example before, let's say we really want to, and it's one of the themes in the letter which we'll get to, we'll talk about in great detail, we want to manage our temper, for example, right? If you happen to have one sometimes, right? Manage anger, temper, losing our temper, right? If you're one of the rare people that sometimes lose their temper, this is a good idea, right? So we want to manage our temper. And we understand, and we'll talk about the concepts of anger, why it's so terrible, and why it's so destructive, and so on and so forth. And we go away with an absolute, resolute commitment, we're going to manage our anger. And it doesn't work. Why doesn't it work? Often it doesn't work for a very simple reason. The process is missing. Meaning, we got the value, we understand it 100%, but we're not setting ourselves up for success. And sometimes the setting ourselves up for success means to create certain boundaries, protective boundaries. It's about reflection. So why and when do I lose my temper? Now, obviously, I'm going to be able to calm it down. The more I understand how terrible it is, how destructive it is, how ineffective it is, that will certainly help. But it also needs a practical implementation and individualized implementation to my context to understand, well, hold on a second. You know, there's certain, I'm just at the beginning of my journey. And it happens to be that there's a certain person I come into contact with that always manages to push my button. I'm just giving an example, right? And it's a person I don't have to live with. I can choose not to. I can choose not to even see the person. Maybe it's a good idea to take a break for a couple of weeks, right? Don't put yourself in the lion's den. Don't put yourself. Or I know that I lose my temper when I'm irritable. Why am I irritable? Am I overworking? Am I doing too much? Maybe I need a rest. Whatever the case is, I'm just saying there's a lot of... I'm just throwing out a few simple examples just for the point. But there's a lot of processing that needs to take place and thinking when we implement personal growth ideas. Right? And that's what Nachmanides is telling his son. He says, "Shema b'ni Musar Avicha, listen, my son, be open. Take it from me. I'm your father. You're my son. Be open to new ideas. Be open to a life of personal growth, a life of refinement, a life of improvement. But don't forsake the teachings of your mother." In other words, you've got to work. You've got to be the mother. You've got to process it. You've got to receive it and then develop it, nurture it. See how it's going to work for you. Talk to other people. Process it. Create the protective boundaries so that the stuff I'm telling you here is actually going to work. One of the things he tells them we'll talk about next week is about calmness, remaining calm. It's related to mindfulness, actually, very, very much. But, okay, that's the idea. That's the value. What are you going to do about it? Each person does something different. Each person has to implement it different. By the way, that's so important, not only for the receiver, but for the giver. In parenting, we know this concept, or in education, we know this idea. King Solomon said, "Chanoch l'nar al pi darko," educate each child according to their way. What does that mean? What, I'm a parent, I should give a different education to each of my children? No. As parents, we have a responsibility to have certain values which we live by, and those values are not negotiable. Those are the values of this house, and that's we have the parents are responsible for establishing what the values of their home is and to try and impart them as best they can. What they do need to know have is the values don't have to change from one child to another, but they have to be applied differently from one child to another. Because each child is different. Each person is different. They have to be implemented different, a little bit different. Each child is a completely different world. So how you implement those, you don't have to change your values, but you do have to change the implementation according to the receiver, because each receiver is different and needs a different process. And that's what Nachmanides is telling his son. So that's the second part of the sentence, that don't forsake the teachings of your mother. First of all, culture, surround yourself by good people. Osmosis, culture, learning from others, positive environment, inspirational environment. And second of all, remember that what I'm teaching you is the father part. It's the giving. It's the value. You have to process it and make sure it's implemented. So that's just, I just thought we'd do that today as just to understand the introductory sentence to this letter. There's another 9 steps to the letter, which we'll pack into another 6 weeks or whatever the case is, and do over the next few weeks. Have a great week.
Thank you.